everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your health and well-being. I find in this world of mass marketing and conflicting theories, it's always great to have a roadmap that can help you get to where you want to go. So when it comes time to make those decisions regarding your health, regarding choices in the marketplace, you really have as much knowledge as possible. So I'm so pleased you are with me today, because today we're having a fantastic conversation exploring the world of our genes. If you've been following any of the health news that's been going on out there in the past year, there have been a lot of really interesting studies that are helping us to understand how our genes, rather than being fixed, set in cement, are actually very pliable, are responding, are changing, are being altered by the foods we eat, the lifestyle choices we make, even the place of peace and quiet within ourselves. So I find this a really fascinating area. And to help us explore this world of our genes, I've invited a very special guest to be with us today. In fact, she's coming to us all the way from Brisbane, Australia. She's up bright and early to be here with us today. I would like to introduce you to Christine Houghton. She is a author of a book called Switched On, Harnessing the Power of Nutrigenomics to Optimize Your Health. And with over 30 years' experience as a private practice clinician in nutritional medicine, Christine is now a research biochemist investigating bioactive plant compounds with significant clinical potential. And her particular interest is focused on nutrigenomics, a strategy for identifying natural compounds capable of upregulating the genes that cells use to prevent disease-promoting processes. And she is such a wealth of knowledge. I'm so excited to have Christine with us. So welcome, Christine, to the show today.
Cheryl, it's a real pleasure to be with you and your listeners.
Well, I am particularly looking forward to having you join me in this conversation today, because I love the field of nutrigenomics. I love what we are learning about the genes. I love the fact that we have such power to alter how these genes get expressed. So we're going to be talking about this whole world, and we're going to start at the beginning, because I'm sure many people might be hearing these terms but not necessarily really understanding them and how it applies to them personally. So let's start right at the beginning. Let's talk about our genes, Christine. What are they? How do they work? What is this emerging field that's known as epigenetics and more specifically nutrigenomics? Fill us in.
Well, the word nutrigenomics is perhaps the easiest place to start, because it's a word made out of two parts, nutra, meaning food or what you eat, and genomics, meaning genes. So we could simplify that by saying it means food talking to your genes. So every mouthful of food that we consume is sending some sort of message to our genes, and depending on what we choose, we're either switching on protective genes or we're switching on the nasty genes which promote inflammation, which subsequently leads to disease. So it puts a whole new spin now on what we eat and why we eat it. We used to think a long time ago that food was just a source of proteins, fats, carbohydrates, vitamins and minerals, and it still is, but it's so much more, and this is the new dimension we didn't used to have. We have in plants, for example, compounds called phytochemicals, and there's now about 10,000 of those identified. And they send subtle signals to our cells, and our cells respond in a way that talks to our genes, the DNA in our genes, and can switch on or switch off certain genes. And that means we now have some control over our health in a way we didn't know we had it. Because depending on what we choose, we can decide to switch on all of the protective genes in our cells, which are going to promote health and well-being, or we can switch on all the nasties and be sick. And we didn't really fully understand this before, so it's pretty exciting. When I was in clinical practice, which I left now in 2004, we didn't know very much about this. It was only just beginning. Because it was only in 2003 that the Human Genome Project was completed, And that means the scientists that had been working on trying to identify all of the genes that make up the human DNA had just finished their project. And that opened up a whole new world of what we can do by manipulating these genes. So that's the exciting field of research that I'm now in, and it's a real delight for me to have opportunities like talking to your listeners to be able to give people a better understanding of ways they can take back control of their own health if, for example, they feel that they're struggling with, you know, health which is less than they'd like it to be.
So there is more to food than just what we've been taught as far as vitamins, minerals, carbohydrates. There's another level.
There is another level.
Information.
Yes.
Would it be correct to say that? Is that a way to say it? Information.
Yes, it would be. But of course, when you look on your nutrition panel on the back of your food product, you're not going to find any of this other information. And one of the reasons for that is, of the 10,000 or so compounds that have now been identified, we only know about a few of them. As research progresses, no doubt we will know more and more about these. But, you know, it's exciting in the fact that now we can look at a food like broccoli or cabbage or cauliflower or some of those sorts of cruciferous vegetables and realize that they have another layer of protective property within them that we didn't ever think that they had. And you won't read it on the nutrition panel. You mightn't even read it in the next 20 years.
Well, that's so fascinating. And before we get into that, because I have lots of questions I want to ask you about that side of things, I just want to go back to the old concept that when we talk about genes, and it's often still talked about a mutation, that we have inherited a gene mutation, and we see it in certain conditions that are passed on or the high probability they'll be passed on, like, I believe, muscular
dystrophy.
Right? Yeah. So, you know, that's one of those conditions. But we're not talking about a gene mutation when we're talking about this emerging field of nutrigenomics and how our genes can be expressed through our diet and lifestyle. We're talking, gene mutation is there's more to the story, and very few people really have true gene mutation. So can you help clarify that?
Yes, I'll do that. You know, there's a handful of diseases which have been identified as being genetic for more than 100 years. We've known about a lot of diseases. Many of them are rare. Some of them are not so rare. Diseases like celiac disease, we know is carried on specific genes. But what we're really talking about is probably a more subtle level where a person can be perhaps generally unwell but not have any identifiable disease. They may prematurely have signs of inflammatory joint problems, sore muscles, fatigue, a lot of the things, the day-to-day aches and pains and grumbles that a lot of people will have. And sometimes people say, oh, well, you know, you get to my age, you get this. But then not everybody gets this at the same age. And so what we've found by looking at the field of nutrigenetics, which is the part where we're actually looking at the gene itself, we can have variations in the normal gene. So the gene may not be completely defective, but it might only be working at, let's say, 60% its normal function. So therefore, a certain gene doesn't get expressed properly. And usually what you find is individuals will have hundreds, if not thousands, of different variations on what we call the normal gene, and that will contribute a whole pattern to that person's well-being. And the beauty of understanding now, and we can do certain tests. In Australia, we use certain testing procedures where we can look at a person's genome, and we're not looking for specific diseases. What we're looking for is defective processes. So I mentioned inflammation before, which is usually tied up with swelling and soreness, and typically people would see it in a joint pain or a muscle pain. We can see that perhaps that individual happens to have inherited from their parents a number of these genes that tend to promote inflammation and maybe didn't get the genes that are anti-inflammatory. So they have the odds stacked against them. That's unfortunate, but the good news from that now is, now that we know that certain foods can influence the expression of that gene, we can take these genes which are, say, operating at 50 or 70% and give them a kick along. They may never get to be the 100% that we would like them to be, but if they got up to 80 or 90%, huge changes happen in the well-being of that person. The fatigue will clear, the joints will feel better, maybe not perfect, but better. So this is what I mean by being able to take control of your own health. So instead of going off to the GP and being prescribed a drug to reduce inflammation, we're going back further down the chain and we're looking for the cause of that problem. And now that we understand that some of that cause is embedded in the genes we inherit from our parents, and better still, that we can influence the expression of those genes, we can now take back that control, forget about the prescription drug or use it minimally, and now do something within our own lifestyle to improve the expression of the genes that we got from our parents.
So when we are looking at symptoms, we've been trained, most of us in the traditional allopathic world, most of us have been trained, you have a symptom, you have an ache and pain, you have some arthritis showing up, you go to the doctor and you are getting a medication. But based on the emerging science of nutrigenomics, what we're learning is that, yes, you may have a number of these genes that are not doing a very good job at dealing with inflammation. And then if you are not eating in the right way or your lifestyle is inappropriate, they could really be faulty and contribute to this chronic systemic inflammatory condition that's going on. However, if you are aware of this knowledge, whether you look at your genes or just get the essence of what you're sharing with people about some of those good choices, you actually can switch on those inflammatory messages so the body is able to cope with inflammation so much better and therefore reduce symptoms. Do I have that right?
Well, what we're doing is we're switching on anti-inflammatory genes and we're switching off the pro-inflammatory genes and we're switching on the anti-inflammatory genes. So that's what we can do by modifying our lifestyle. And part of that lifestyle is what we eat, but it isn't just about eating. It can be getting enough sleep, enough exercise, so on. Avoiding excessive caffeine and alcohol, the usual story. But there's a reason for these now. There's a very good reason.
So we're getting to even more bottom line. It's not just about taking a bunch of supplements necessarily. It's about reading your body. I always talk about nutrigenomics as being able to hit the bullseye with personalized nutrition, which is what is really that new emerging field.
Yes, it is. And, for a long time in practice, we've talked about personalized nutrition and we've talked about biochemical individuality, which means we're all born different. But until we've been able to look at the genome, we haven't really had the ability to decide who's got this type of individuality and who's got that. So we're on the right track, but we didn't know what to do about it. Now we've got a tool to evaluate the gene profile and look at the weaknesses and the strengths in an individual. And on top of that, now we've got the tools that can influence those abnormally functioning genes and kick them along so that they behave more as if they were functioning normally.
Recently there was a study that came out that showed by doing 8 hours of meditation, in the study they had these people do 8 hours of meditation, and after 8 hours of meditation they saw a variety of genes that actually were switched on. They were working more appropriately. Does that fit into the realm of nutrigenomics as a lifestyle factor?
Yes, it does very much. And your listeners may know of Dr. Bruce Lipton, who worked in mainstream science for many years and now promotes this concept that what you think is changing your gene expression. He talks about the biology of your gene. And he hasn't coined this term, but I would call that psychogenomics. So you're using your mind to change the expression of your genes. And there are quite a few studies now that are coming out along these lines. So when we talk about lifestyle, we're bringing all of these factors into account, and by calming the mind, we're clearly having an influence on the way our genes are expressed.
Yeah, it's pretty fascinating. I even saw a study that said if you get a sense of happiness by making a contribution, so you have a greater purpose for what you're doing and you feel good about it, you alter different genes than if you just did something to make you feel happy, like buy yourself a new pair of shoes.
Yes, well, it's fascinating, isn't it? And we're only just scratching the tip of this huge iceberg of new information. It's really exciting when you look at the possibilities of understanding more about how your body is behaving. I mean, in the past, we've been able to look at a blood test, for example, or an X-ray, but that's the end result of what's going on at the gene level. We haven't necessarily known why certain people have things turning up on their blood test. So now we go back a couple of steps and we say, okay, well, you inherited this gene from your mother's side of the family and you inherited this from your father's side of the family. Don't feel depressed about that. I mean, don't say everybody in my family died of heart attacks, so that's going to happen to me too, because it isn't. A lot of what we think we inherit is sometimes inheriting bad habits. I mean, all the people in that family that inherited the heart disease might have had the same bad lifestyle habits, so it isn't necessarily inherited. It can be an acquired habit. So, again, giving us back control so that we understand that we have a lot more control than I think we have believed we could have. That doesn't mean we go off the prescription drugs in an instant. We might decide we're going to embark on this new nutrigenomic path, leave the prescription drugs where they are as the GP prescribed them. As you start to improve your general health and well-being, the GP will notice that. Things will change in your blood and your well-being, and those prescriptions will gradually be reduced until you don't need them or you don't need many of them, depending on your particular circumstance.
So what I find fascinating, blood workup right now is the primary way we assess what's going on. But actually, the blood workup, looking at your cholesterol, looking at your C-reactive protein, looking at your folic acid, your B12, some of these major markers, are really just little indicators of deeper issues that are not functioning well based on this genomic communication going on. And we can use the blood workup to monitor what we're doing, see how effective we are. But there's something else that gives us much more primary changes within our body, within ourselves.
I see the blood test results as being a flag that your body's holding up that says, hey, look over here, notice this, this is not right. Mm-hmm. That doesn't tell you why it's not right. If we can backtrack a couple of steps to look at the genome, now we're starting to get some clues as to why that's not right. And that's what gives us this whole new dimension.
Yeah, you know, I find it really exciting because when we can appreciate, as it's emerging now, that some of those gene expressions that are addressed in genomic testing are looking at genes that are affecting inflammation, either the inability to switch off, the inability to switch on, or genes that impact how well our liver can detoxify. Those processes are so fundamental to the creation of the chronic illnesses that we are all dealing with in this 21st century. So we're actually getting as upstream as we can get to the triggers that can initiate, whether it's diabetes, whether it's Alzheimer's, whether it's cancer, whether it's cardiovascular disease, autoimmune diseases, everything that's right now the plagues in our culture are generated by this interplay of these abilities to support these processes.
I couldn't have said it better, Cheryl.
Oh, that's exactly right.
That is exactly right. And some of those underlying processes are common to all of those diseases that you named and other chronic diseases. You know, the most fundamental upstream factor we consider is oxidative stress. So that oxidative stress, we often use the term free radical to describe what's happening, but every breath of oxygen we take into our lungs, some of that oxygen gets moved off sideways to create this compound called superoxide, and that's what we sometimes term a free radical or a reactive oxygen species. And that superoxide, if it gets out of control, sets off a trigger of damage throughout the cells, ultimately leading to inflammation, and then inflammation leads to a whole host of diseases that we see. So that superoxide of itself is not a bad guy. It's a signal to the cell. And an example would be this. If you and I decided we were going to go off and run very quickly down the end of the road, we would start puffing, we would be bringing in more oxygen into our lungs. Now our circulation is opening up, the muscles in the legs need more blood. We are now starting to produce more waste materials. All of that going through the system is now a requirement for the cells to respond in a certain way. So what happens is this, that superoxide, which is the little bit spun off from the oxygen, it's about 4% of the oxygen you breathe goes off to superoxide. So the more you breathe, because the faster you're running, the more superoxide you produce. That's a signal, and that tells the cell, oh, look, we could be in danger here. We better switch on our defenses. And that's how your body responds to those sorts of stresses. So when you're exercising, the superoxide is the signal. It switches on all of these genes associated with the cell's defense system, and now the cell can respond. Now it can more quickly detoxify the waste materials that are coming from your muscles because they're working harder. It can eliminate these free radicals. It can reduce inflammatory cytokines, as we call them. That's the benefit of exercise. You are switching on your own defenses. So what I think is often misunderstood in the world of antioxidants is, unfortunately, we've been given this idea that all free radicals are bad and all antioxidants are good, instead of understanding that the superoxide, the first free radical, is a signal to the cell. It's only a problem if your cell can't respond to it. So if that superoxide starts getting up to excessive levels, your body very cleverly produces an enzyme called superoxide dismutase, and that then combines with the superoxide, turns it into just water and oxygen. It's now completely harmless and it does no damage. So it starts off as a signal, and then any excessive amount is just mopped up, if you like, and prevents damage. This only works if you're able to produce the superoxide dismutase enzyme. And so we can look at the human genome and we can see that there is a gene for superoxide dismutase. So if you've got the normally functioning superoxide dismutase gene, or SOD, we'll call it, everything's fine. You don't tend to generate a lot of inflammation. But if you inherited one of the weaker forms of SOD gene, then you're more likely to have problems in this area. And so that's where we can look at particular supplements which can activate that SOD gene and can have it producing that enzyme more normally, so that the free radical damage that might otherwise occur doesn't get out of control. So it's not, again, this simple idea that the more antioxidants I take, the better I'm going to be. It doesn't work like that. And the problem is that some people take so many antioxidant supplements, they're just blocking that signal. So when we go for our long run down the road, and we're trying to listen to our cells are listening to that superoxide signal so it can switch on its defenses. If we've drowned ourselves in bucket loads of miscellaneous antioxidants just because we thought they were good for us, we're going to switch off that signal and we'll do ourselves harm. So that's the new and emerging science of antioxidants, which has now come out of this whole understanding of how cells protect themselves.
Well, so is that part of the theory with chemotherapy, you know, this controversy? Do you give support, supplements, antioxidants with chemo and radiation, or best not to while that process is going on?
Well, that's a complicated story, and we don't have all the answers. But quite simply, this can be an issue. So many of those chemo drugs are designed to act like free radicals. They are what we call pro-oxidant, and they're designed to kill the cancer cells. So if you dump a whole heap of antioxidants into the cell, you can block the signal that that drug is trying to send to the cancer cells. So you can reduce the effectiveness of that drug. So my advice is never to mix up antioxidant supplements with chemo drugs. This is not about whether you want to have chemo or you don't want to have it. If a patient has decided they're on the chemo track, then I think we need to stand back and let the oncologist do what he needs to do and let the chemo do what it's supposed to do, not try and interfere in that way. Once the patient is not on chemo, that's a different matter. Now you can say, okay, there's been a lot of damage done to the good cells as well as the cancer cells in this person. Let's now get in and increase the cell's defences and try to clean up the damage that has been done as quickly as we possibly can. That's typically my advice to people on chemo, because I think we don't know enough yet about exactly what's happening. And the other thing is, too, chemo is just not one recipe. Each patient will have a different cocktail of chemo drugs, sometimes 10, 12 different drugs, all designed to attack the cancer cell in a different way. So for us to get in there and meddle with that, I think is completely unfair to the patient. It's certainly unfair to the oncologist, who is expecting a certain outcome from what he or she is doing. And then there's some other factor niggling along in the background. A lot of patients will say, oh, I'm not going to tell my oncologist I'm doing that. I don't think they do themselves a service. And unfortunately, you know, this notion that all antioxidants are good and all free radicals are bad gets taken to the extreme, and I think sometimes poor advice is given to people who have such serious illnesses. And if they've already elected to go down the chemo track, then I think we all need to respect that and say, okay, let this treatment do what it's designed to do and not meddle with it.
Yes, it's a little more complicated than what most of us really understand. So I am learning as well, which is good. You know, learning is good. Being able to keep changing your thoughts and beliefs about things is a good thing. While we're on this subject of kind of chemo, let's just talk a moment about the breast cancer gene, which has gotten such publicity. Can you enlighten us from your perspective?
Is that the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes
yes.
that you're
yes.
talking about? Well, they're protective genes within the cell. So, you know, the people who have the normally functioning BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes have an added level of protection. So the women who have the problems or the potential problems are the ones who have abnormal variants of those genes. So the cell is not able to give that tissue the protection that it should have. Whether it necessitates bilateral mastectomy is not for me to say or to judge, even though that's what a lot of women or some women tend to be doing now. It's interesting, too, that BRCA1 and BRCA2 gene, both of them, are part of what I'm calling the cell's own defences. So when I said earlier, you know, there are ways that we can switch on the cell's defences nutrigenomically, those genes are part of that whole list of cell defensive genes. So whether we can sufficiently influence the expression of those genes nutrigenomically with food and lifestyle, I don't know. No one's done the research to be able to say, okay, you don't need to do the mastectomy, we can do this. We don't know that. So I would be really reluctant to, you know, advise women, but what I would think was, if you're suspicious, or if you know that you have those abnormal genes, you certainly do need to improve your lifestyle. I would suggest that not every woman who has defective BRCA1 and BRCA2 inherited genes is necessarily going to develop breast cancer. And that could also be because these are not the only two genes that cause cancer. I mean, there's a whole host of genes which are going wrong when a person develops cancer, and they're probably quite different for each person, and they're probably quite different even between identical twins.
Yes, I've seen pictures of identical twins who don't look identical anymore as they went through their lives having different experiences, eating different foods, and they look very different, actually. So
it's fascinating, isn't it, when you look at that? There's been some stories of, you know, one twin lived in Boston all her life and the other twin lived in London all her life, and, you know, they meet for their 60th birthday. And this has been done by actually looking at their genomes. And even though they're born with the same fundamental DNA, there's now what we call epigenetic changes that are overlying those genes, and that seems to be a lot of what's making the difference. And when I'm talking about epigenetics, epi means upon, so it's like something on top of the gene. And I liken it to a paperclip. And you can clip this paperclip onto certain genes, and you could take the paperclip off later. And what that paperclip does is it will switch a gene on or switch it off. It usually suppresses it. So, for example, if a woman was born even with normal BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes, but she lived a terrible lifestyle, she could get these little paperclips clipped onto the top of those BRCA1, BRCA2 genes and switch them off anyway. So that's what we call epigenetics. But the beauty of epigenetics is these are changes that you can make in your own lifetime. They're not cast in concrete. You can take the paper clips off just as you can put the paper clips on. And this, you know, adds a whole new dimension and a far more complex dimension than the ones we've been talking about before. But nevertheless, it's a growing new field. And when you see identical twins changing over time, you go, how can that be? They've got exactly the same DNA. Well, what they've got now is each one has different paper clips attached to different parts of their genome. And so they are subtly changing, and this can be measured. There's been studies where they've measured this, and it's quite clear that the genomes are different.
Based on those little paper clips that turn things on and off, based on their diet, their stress levels, their exercise levels, their nutritional status, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are the things that are determining those little metaphorical paper clips,
yes,
of how our genes are turning on and off. It's all the things we do in our life. Everything,
yes,
we eat, we think,
yes,
how we move, that
everything
is altering our genes. Because, you know, it's, to me, one of the most profound revelations when I started learning about this is how pliant our genes are. They're changing all the time. They're changing with every thought. They're not rigid. They are actually moving and morphing, as in a sense, as we are experiencing ourselves through life and with what we eat, what we think, what we do. That's, which is empowering if you take responsibility for your health, but it can be a problem if you don't take responsibility for your health and do things that support your health.
Exactly. And the sobering thing, I think, and I've written this in my book, Switched On, is that these little paper clips, these epigenetic changes that occur due to how we live our lives, can actually move on to the next generation, so that if a young man or a young woman, let's say at 25, decide they're going to start a family, and they've been doing the things that, you know, late teens and 20s do, and late nights, too much alcohol, parties, da-da, whatever, abusing their bodies in certain ways, they will have accumulated some epigenetic paper clips that they may pass on to their children. And that's a pretty sobering thought, because at the time of your life when you're most likely to abuse your health is the time that you're really laying down these paper clips. Later on, when you get to your 40s and 50s and so on, you're more likely then to lead a much more temperate life. But it doesn't matter anymore then for the next generation, because you're not procreating anymore.
You know, that's going to, I have a lot I want to say, but I'm going to wait until we come back from our break. So we're about to take a short break. We are having this fantastic conversation. My guest today is Christine Houghton. She's the author of Switched On, Harnessing the Power of Nutrigenomics to Optimize Your Health. And don't go away, because the conversation continues. We'll be right back. Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. Welcome back to What Women Must Know. We are talking to Christine Houghton. She's coming to us all the way from gorgeous Brisbane, Queensland in Australia. And she is the author of Switched On, Harnessing the Power of Nutrigenomics to Optimize Your Health. And we're talking about the emerging science of nutrigenomics, which allows us, through specific nutritional choices, lifestyle choices, be that exercise, be it sleep, can actually optimize expression of certain genes, get them giving the right messages and communications as best as possible. So we've been talking, Christine, about the consequences of these very changeable genes, the fact that it's there are genes and how well they are expressing, how well they are communicating to all the key processes in the body is either doing a great job of it or they're just getting lazy and not being able to communicate well, not only impacts our health, but impacts the health of the children. And what I wanted to just say about that, because I've been working with several hundreds of patients now with nutrigenomic testing, I am able to see generations. You know, I can see mom, I can see the babies, I can, you know, sometimes grandma's even in there. And what I've noticed, Christine, is that with each generation, those nutrigenomic expressions are getting more and more compromised. So the health of our children or the genomic expressions, what they've inherited, are struggling even more to be able to do these processes, to have proper communication. And as a result, I just see, you know, this growing incidence of conditions like, you know, type 2 diabetes in children or autism, because I can see the impaired ability to manage inflammation, oxidative stress, inability to deal with the toxins in the world from a genomic perspective. Do you have any thoughts on that? Have you?
Very much, Cheryl, and I'd like us to just carry on from the epigenetic thread that we were on before the break and just look at why human cells put these little epigenetic paper clips there as tags to switch genes on and switch genes off. And cells do it as a way of adapting to the environment of the time. So let's go back, say, 100 years or so, and an imaginary grandmother was involved in a situation where she lived in a famine environment. So she is still falling pregnant, she is still having children, but she's living through famine. So in order that her body can survive that famine, enormous changes have to occur in the body. So the body can change its metabolism and adapt to the fact that there's not only little food, but there's very limited nutrients in that food. Now, typically, during pregnancy, the baby will take first pick of the nutrients and the mother will miss out if there's not enough to go around. So that's one of nature's adaptive responses. So every bit of calcium that's rounded up in that body is going to go into the baby's skeleton. So that's great. The baby gets off to a good start. But what also happens is the child who was conceived while that woman was living through this famine will carry those epigenetic tags with it into the next generation. So this child now is adapted to famine. However, the child now is growing up in, you know, the 30s or the 40s or the 50s in the US or anywhere in the world. Now the food supply is more generous and there's no famine, and yet this mother is now, as she's growing into adulthood herself, she's now having to deal with the fact that the body is geared up to famine. So the slightest bit of extra food that's floating around is going to turn into the fat stores. Fast forward another generation, and that woman now has a child, and that child is now the granddaughter of the original woman who was in the famine. That child has now carried those epigenetic tags from the famine days, also the ones the mother acquired in her adulthood, and now we're seeing this genomic situation with this adaptation to famine in an environment where we are bombarded by junk food, bucket loads of calories of all the wrong kind. The body is not in a famine, and now we're seeing obesity like we've never known it before on this planet, and all of the consequences of that obesity, the type 2 diabetes, the cardiovascular disease, the inflammatory diseases of all kinds, and inflammation, incidentally, is made much worse from obesity as an initiator.
So we have to understand how profound it is to take responsibility for ourselves and for future generations, the health. And, you know, one of the things I've been looking at is this tendency of living longer. We're all living longer, but we are not living healthier towards the latter part of our lives. And this is where I'm particularly interested in learning from my own gene expressions, how I can optimize their expression so I can live healthy healthy in my latter years and not live in a debilitated state, because this is what we actually have control over. We have great influence in how we live the quality of our lives.
Exactly. And, there are ways that we can change our lifestyle, of course, to optimize cell function. So that's the best we can aim to do. Whatever Mother Nature does inside human cells to make them function at their peak, we need to know what that is and we need to adopt that. Those are the best tools we have. Unfortunately, some of the people who are living these long, not so healthy lives are being propped up by modern medicine, being propped up by pharmaceuticals. Without those drugs and other tools of modern medicine, those people would probably, in all likelihood, have died some years before they're living now. But as you point out, too, that's not quality of life. And what's the point of living a long life if you're not comfortable, feeling well as those years advance?
So with your research in nutrigenomics and specific nutrients that support optimal gene expression, what can you share with us some of the tips that we should be aware of, we should be perhaps incorporating in our diet? Or I know you've been working with some supplementation. So let's talk about some specific things that we should all be aware of, whether we get our genomic test done or whether we never do that. There are some things that I know you're working with that would be beneficial for all of us.
My research is on a compound that comes from broccoli, and it's called sulforaphane, funny name. And I'll come back to that in a minute, but I just want to speak about a switch that's in the cell. Now, the reason I call my book Switched On is because it is about these little chemical switches which are in the cell. And there's one switch which switches on the vast majority of these genes that the cell uses to protect itself. So this switch called NRF2 is a little bit like the switch on the wall, and all of these genes are like the lights on your Christmas tree. So I go over to the wall and I put on one switch and I switch on hundreds of lights on my Christmas tree. That's what it's like with this NRF2 switch inside the cell. If you can switch that on, you switch on all these protective genes at the same time. You can also switch off a number of damaging genes at the same time. So this is a pretty amazing switch. If we can get control of this switch, or at least partly control it, we have a powerful tool by which we can enhance our cell's own defense system. So that compound that I'm working with in the lab is this compound sulforaphane that is derived from the broccoli family. And it is known to be the most potent activator of this NRF2 switch, which is inside the cell. And there's a lot of work being done on this over the last 20 years or so. Johns Hopkins University initiated the work on this back in the early 90s, and it's really accelerating ever since. There are now more than 900 papers being published on the ability of sulforaphane to activate the cell's own defences. So the thing about the sulforaphane is that it's not actually found in the broccoli vegetable, and I'll tell you why that sounds contradictory. What's in the vegetable are two little sacs. One has a precursor compound called glucoraphin, and it's locked up in its little sac inside the broccoli cell. And there's another compound, an enzyme called myrosinase, and it's locked up in its other little vesicle inside the cell, its own little compartment. So those two compartments never mix until you chop or break or chew the broccoli plant. Once you do that, the enzyme acts on the other compound, and that's what produces the sulforaphane. So it's only produced when you chop it or eat it, or in the case of a supplement that's been made from a whole broccoli plant, then as soon as that supplement gets wet in your digestive tract, it activates. The sulforaphane isn't very stable. It only lasts for a few hours in your system, so you have to make it on demand. So if you see a supplement that claims to contain sulforaphane, something is very wrong. It doesn't contain sulforaphane, or if it did, it only lasted for a few hours. So what we've done in our research is we've worked out a way to take broccoli sprouts, which are about 50 times more concentrated in this ability to produce sulforaphane than the vegetable that we typically eat. And we've been able to concentrate it in a way to keep the two little compartments in the cell separate and keep the enzyme alive so that when you swallow that capsule, the reaction starts and you get your sulforaphane. So that opens up a whole potential for enhancing cell function. Now, some people would say, look, I'll just eat plenty of broccoli. There's a couple of problems with that. First of all, the broccoli vegetable just doesn't have enough in it to make a real difference. If you've already got some established condition, you want to make changes, you're probably not going to get enough just out of eating the vegetable. But the big problem is, as soon as you heat that vegetable, which is what you do when you cook it, you kill the enzyme. So you can't produce the sulforaphane anyway. It would only work if you're eating it raw, and not many people eat raw broccoli. There's a further problem. The broccoli plant actually contains a thing called an enzyme inhibitor, and some types of broccoli seed contain large amounts of this inhibitor, so you don't end up getting much sulforaphane anyway. So it's pretty much hit and miss whether eating broccoli vegetable, even raw, is going to give you what you're looking for. And even if you sprout the seeds yourself and you say, well, look, I'll grow the seeds into sprouts and I'll have that, you've still got the issue with the inhibitor. And the commercially available seeds just don't tell you whether the inhibitor's present or not. Certainly eating sprouts of any kind is a good source of fundamental vitamins and minerals, so there's no doubt you're going to get that. But if you're really looking for the sulforaphane to activate these protective switches, you really need to look for some sort of a standardised supplement where they've done the research on it, they know what it produces, you're going to have the enzyme intact in the cell and it's going to be produced at the moment that you consume it. So when you get all those things right, now you can start to switch on these protective genes and switch off the pro-inflammatory genes in the way that you'd expect.
And when you can complete that process biochemically, what are all the benefits from the sulforaphane that's produced when you have broccoli?
We've got about 1,700 to 2,500 genes that are switched on, so we don't even know all about all of those just yet. But we do know about some basic categories. You mentioned them before, the detoxification genes. They're all switched on via this process. So the sulforaphane activates the NRF2 switch. The NRF2 goes into that nucleus, the part of the cell where the gene is housed, lines itself up on the gene, switches it on, and it starts making many, many copies of the detoxification enzyme. So if you happen to have some toxic material in your cells, let's suppose you're working in an underground car park and you're breathing in all the fumes from the motor vehicles. You've got all these petrochemical toxins in your cells. That registers in your cell. You switch on the detoxification and enzymes, and hopefully you will safely detoxify those compounds and they'll do you no harm. So that's the first type of thing you'll see. The cell switches on the synthesis of a compound called glutathione, which is one of the cell's natural antioxidant compounds. Very beneficial to be able to switch that on. That's an antioxidant compound that is produced in large quantities within the cell. It's not something you can consume as a supplement because the cell is just producing it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, continuously as the cell requires it. You can produce a compound called metallothionein, and that's a heavy metal chelator. So if you've got heavy metals in your system like lead or mercury or something like that, cadmium, metallothionein binds that up and safely gets rid of it out of the body. So those are the sorts of processes that occur. And you'll see now we're not talking about any disease here. We're just talking about enhancing these processes that the cell uses to take care of itself.
And the thing that's impressive about what you are doing in your lab, you actually are testing these foods. You're helping to formulate them. In the case of that broccoli sprout powder, you actually have been able to maintain the enzymes that is necessary so all these biological processes can proceed. That's what's so profound about your you know, your work. You're really looking for what is going to successfully accomplish this ability to switch all those genes back on again, or switch the ones on or the ones off that need to be done appropriately.
Well, that's been the challenge in the research, because there are products on the market which are called broccoli sprout or broccoli seed extracts. And as soon as you set out to make an extract, you deactivate the essential enzyme, the myrosinase enzyme. So those products don't work. So all they do is they're containing the precursor. They don't contain the enzyme that's necessary to produce the sulforaphane. So, yes, our work, we've been working on this since about 2007, working on this to optimize this function, and we're still tweaking the edges to try and enhance it even further. So we have to get rid of that enzyme inhibitor and keep the enzyme present. And what we'd like to do is work with 100% whole broccoli sprout powder. We don't want to extract anything, because Mother Nature put thousands of different compounds into this broccoli sprout. Why is it that we've decided that we're only going to use the sulforaphane? All of those compounds will be acting together in the way that Mother Nature intended, even if we don't fully understand exactly how that works at this point.
So by supporting this pathway in your research, what are some of, if I can ask, if this is the right question to ask, some of the benefits physiologically, what improves in a person when they include
this? The first thing most people will notice is they'd actually feel more energy or more stamina or more endurance. So that's one of the first things that most people will report, even people who don't have anything particularly to complain about health-wise, will just say they feel more energy. I've known people in their 60s who find, you know, they go for a run every morning. Now they find they can just run that bit further before they run out of energy. So that's a common finding. A lot of what people experience will depend on their particular weaknesses. I know of an asthmatic patient who has been taking this supplement for some time, and found that even though she still needs to use her puffer occasionally, she's not using it 3 and 4 times a day anymore. She's using it occasionally. So, again, that occurs because asthma, or asthma, as you call it in the US, is a condition which involves inflammation on the linings of the bronchioles in the lungs. So if you reduce that inflammation, which is what you're going to do with the sulforaphane, you won't get the spasms, which is characteristic of the disease. So that's why, even though there are certain genes which predispose people to these sorts of respiratory disorders, we may not be able to change those inherited genes, but we can change the inflammation which is affecting the expression of those genes. So again, you see an unexpected benefit. If you don't have a lung problem, you wouldn't notice that, of course. There are other people who find their blood pressure reduces because the lining of the blood vessel, the endothelium, is very susceptible to inflammation. And if that becomes inflamed in the lining of that blood vessel, that will often trigger off the spasm in the blood vessel that shoots the blood pressure up. So again, we're talking about changing fundamental principles of physiology. And it'll be different for every person because people have different weaknesses. Some people will find their digestion is better because we know sulforaphane actually has a direct effect on killing the Helicobacter organism. So some people have a lot of reflux and similar sorts of problems whereby they may take various drugs to try and get control of it. But sulforaphane has been known to kill the Helicobacter pylori organism. Even at reasonably modest doses, you don't have to take huge doses for that. Some people have irritable bowel syndrome. A lot of that irritability in the bowel will settle too with the effect of sulforaphane. Because we know sulforaphane activates a compound in the intestinal wall called beta-defensin, and beta-defensin is a little bit like an antibiotic that the intestine produces for itself. And if you can activate that, you tend to minimize some of the adverse effects that might be going on down in those lower intestinal areas.
Well, I think it's really exciting. I want to be sure before we kind of come to the end that people, first of all, know how to get your book switched on, Harnessing the Power of Nutrigenomics to Optimize Your Health. What's the best place for them?
Look, the easiest place, I think, Cheryl, is to go to Amazon, and you can download it as a Kindle book.
Oh, okay.
That's probably
okay,
the easiest thing to do.
Okay.
The printed book is, you know, can be mailed. It can be purchased from us in Australia. But the Kindle book, I think, is probably the easiest way to get it immediately.
Okay. And you're looking for Christine Houghton, and I'll spell her surname, Houghton. So be sure you spell it correctly. And I want to mention that the product you've been researching, which I was introduced to when I was in Australia, this my summer, your winter,
yes.
Which is where I was very privileged to be able to connect with you, has been quite a revelation. What I've been learning from you, Christine, the research I've been reading, your research, and the product that's now available just recently in the U.S., I just want to mention the name of it because I know people are going to be curious, and we want them to get the right product. And it's called EnduraCell, EnduraCell. And if people are interested, they can go to my website at my store because I am providing that product for people, for my patients. I personally am using it now, and, you know, I really feel the benefit. Actually, when I came back from my last trip to Australia, I was noticing I was getting a little inflammation in the joints of my forefinger, and I started taking their product, the EnduraCell, and it's gone. So there you
Excellent.
Go. Mm-hmm. You know, that was the main thing that I changed or included. So is there a website?
Well, there's EnduraCell.com to learn more about the product.
Okay.
If people are going to that website, they'll see another product called Defense Cell, DefenCell, and that's a combination which has a lot of other trace elements and so on in it. So if you're just starting out taking supplements and you just wanted to take one thing, Defense Cell would be the place I would suggest someone might start.
And these are they're foods really. They're foods that have a huge impact. So it's really something the whole family can incorporate into their diet, right? Just it's a little powder, for at least the one form of it is a powder. I know you have some as capsules, so you can just everyone's safe to it's good for you, right?
It is. It's a food and it's 100% whole food powder. So it's just we haven't tinkered around with it. It's just the way Mother Nature made it. There's nothing added, nothing removed. It's just the way we grow it and produce the supplement that's unique, and that's what we do that captures the activity so that we can be sure we are producing the sulforaphane.
Well, thank you so much, Christine Houghton, for what you are doing. You know, I'm so grateful for you because I am always searching for what is out there that's the best, that's going to get the job done, that really is working in the, the pathways. I really want to support my patients and, of course, give myself as much advantage to staying healthy. So I just so appreciate the work you've been doing. You've helped to explain a very complicated area so well and have been so committed to then bringing this into practical application. So thank you for being with us today. Thank you for coming all the way from Brisbane in Queensland, Australia. And, many, many thank yous for all the people whose lives you are touching and transforming.
It's been my very great pleasure, Cheryl. Thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
It's been a pleasure. And it's been a pleasure to be with all of you out there. I trust you will continue to grow and learn. And remember to always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.